ignoring the people of his state. Won't listen, won't bargain, won't negotiate. That's why there's 14 senators sneaking across the border. 14 senators, capital disorder. 14 senators, new Wisconsin heroes. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. Protests are growing.
Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. Just to keep an update on Hollis Malin's hunger strike, he is now in day 72. We have a great show coming up for you today. We have Ann Manning for Wealth of the Common Good. Then we have a recorded interview with Tamarine Cornelius from the Wisconsin Budget Project and Wisconsin Council of Children and Families, followed by Harry Weisbrand from the Job Party, and we're going to be discussing him organizing students as well. We also have WINS Network's 3-Minute World News and an exciting new segment is the Progressive Point of View with Matt Rothschild. If you'd like to call in, the number is 310-742-1896, and my toll-free number is 877-497-1797. If you want to just give your name when you get on the show, that would be great. We also have a live discussion on blogtalkradio.com. It's a chat. You can ask a question. I will answer it on the air, or ask the guest to answer it. You could download my show as a free podcast on iTunes or from my show page at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. And you can find me on my Facebook page, The Sarah Schultz Show. Well, I'd like to start this week's show of talking about where I have been this week. I was at the and I still am, at the Democracy Convention in Madison, Wisconsin. If you hadn't heard about it, this was a convention that was put together. It was started, it seems to have a lot of Wisconsin people in it. It's a national convention. A lot of great talkers, a lot of great sessions, all talking about democracy. How can we bring democracy back? It's great stuff going on. I have really learned a lot. If you're in the area, or come on down Saturday and Sunday to catch it. It started Wednesday. It's going to go through Sunday at 6. If you're in Wisconsin, from 3:30 to 6, they have a Wisconsin meeting. It's really a lot of fun. If you can't be here, if you're somewhere you can't make it, you can watch it online at Ustream Live, and look for their podcast coming up soon because they've been trying to record all the sessions. There is just a lot to cover. So I really just learned a lot. Speaking of the things I've learned, I found out that I was really not being inclusive when I was talking about things. I try to let the idea of the show is that we the people are now in session. It needs to be all people. It can't be just some people. And I realized through going to these sessions that I wasn't including all people. When I was talking about average. Average, average, average. The average Wisconsinite, middle class, maybe working class, but we're white, really. If you think of Wisconsin, that's what you're thinking of. And that's not all of Wisconsin. Wisconsin's got a Hmong population. Wisconsin's got a huge Native American population. Wisconsin's got an African American population. Wisconsin's got a Latino population. Wisconsin's got all different people here. So when I start talking again, as I continue these interviews, as the show continues to go on, I am going to be more inclusive. I'm going to start asking the guests about the people of color. How do these things affect the people of color? How do these things affect the working class? Sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're not. But that's a discussion we're not having. And if we want to take back our state, if we want to have Wisconsin to become a whole state again, we truly want democracy to come back to our state, we need to include everybody, not just some. So listen for that. You'll hear it today in the interviews I do. You'll hear it from now on. And I think it's really good that we all start doing that so we could have everyone come together. With that being said, I'm so excited, I actually have the weekly news roundup this week. Mad World. You mean we have more recalls? Yes, we do. There are two mayors being recalled in Wisconsin right now. We have an Ashland mayor, Bill Whelan. He's being recalled. Allegedly, his administration is not being transparent enough in handling contracts, open record requests, and closed sessions. According to the Ashland Current, in February, there was a complaint filed alleging the city council held an illegal closed session related to the salary of a city position. The complainant largely blamed Whelan for allowing the closed session to occur, and the Ashland County District Attorney's Office ultimately forced the council to reconsider its action in open session. That's already a done deal. They already have enough signatures for it. It's already been set. His recall election is set for October 4th. Now, we also have the Sheboygan mayor, Bob Ryan, he's not being recalled yet. There are people working on his recall. According to the Sheboygan Press, the mayor allegedly, after going on a three-day drinking binge, apparently, this all included, I'm going to read a list of stuff that he did, and this all happened after a three-day drinking binge, according to the Sheboygan Press. There was a barroom scuffle that drew police to the scene. He passed out in a bar, reportedly was making an array of lewd comments to women, and then lying about the events afterwards. Now, the Sheboygan community put together a committee of the whole, and that was put in charge to decide on who was going to look into the complaints filed. They voted on Thursday night, actually, to look into hiring former U.S. Attorney Stephen Biskup to serve as special prosecutor. So they're still going on signatures. There's actually a meeting coming up, I believe, September 2nd. They're still going through the process, but I will be following those stories. I will bring it as I get updates. I'll let you know. But apparently people are not afraid to speak out anymore. When they don't like what's going on, they're going to stand up and do something. And regardless of what happens, regardless if they're guilty or not, I don't know, I'm not there. But the fact that people have the power to stand up and say no more, I think that in itself says something to what's going on. Walker's budget in action. Marathon County will be looking to raise its taxes. Why? Well, because they're looking at a $1.1 million deficit due to the stagnant property taxes. It was $500,000. They just lost another $600,000. Walker's budget does not include any help to the municipalities, which include the counties, cities, towns. So now when you're looking at a $1.1 million deficit, you're looking to raise taxes. Apparently, those are the tools Walker was given everyone to use. We're not going to raise taxes on you, but you can. This is the first of many of these stories. And finally, I'd like to congratulate Senator Jessica King. She was sworn in on August 26th, which was yesterday, at 1 p.m. at the Leach Amphitheater. She was sworn in by Justice Abramson. This is the first time a Democratic senator has provided over Oshkosh since the early 80s, and this is the first time a Democrat sat in the 18th Senate seat district since 1956. Hard to spin that one, isn't it? So congratulations to Jessica King, our new senator. Now we're waiting for Ann Manning to come on. She'll be on in just a moment. But while we do that, I'm going to tell you about this week's activities. There is actually a soup kitchen going on in Janesville. Now, I live in Paul Ryan's district, so you're going to hear a lot about Paul Ryan because, number one, I want you to know what he's doing. And number two, it's just good to know because he's not the only one in Wisconsin who's doing this. There's other U.S. Congressman in Wisconsin pulling stuff like this. But since I'm on the front line here, I know about it. So you'll hear that. If you have a senator or a representative that's really causing problems or there's some problems fundraising or you have to pay $15 to see him like I have to pay Paul Ryan to see him face-to-face or on a teleconference, let me know if you're going to organize anything. We'll get it out for you, because it's important that we all get together to do this. So this soup kitchen It's called the Soup Kitchen and Speak Out in Janesville at U.S. Congressman Paul Ryan's office, 5 to 7 p.m. on September 1st. The office itself is 20 South Main Street in Janesville, Wisconsin. And like I said, if you have activities planned for your representatives because they're doing something you don't like and you want to speak out against it, email me at sarahschultzshow@gmail.com. Let me know, and we will definitely get your stuff out there because it's important. We need to speak up. With that being said, we're going to have the Progressive Minute.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Thursday was the day that Scott Walker's vicious cuts took effect in Wisconsin, gouging state workers' paychecks by 9% or more. By Thursday afternoon, about 1,000 protesters had gathered outside the state capitol in Madison to denounce Walker. My friend Bill Franks, a union steward for AFT Wisconsin, had a warning for Walker. "The dogs of recall are on the governor's tail. Release the hounds," he said. At 6 o'clock, most of the crowd entered the Capitol, chanting pro-union slogans and singing Solidarity Forever. Then it was decision time. Would a big group stay in the Capitol and risk arrest, or would everyone disperse? Turns out that only 13 people stayed, mostly the hardcore who'd engaged in civil disobedience several times this past spring. They respectfully refused to leave, linking arms when the police came in to make their arrests. I admire these practitioners of civil disobedience. I only wish the organizers had gotten commitments from hundreds more to stay and risk arrest, said one of the protesters just before he was hauled away. "We had the numbers, but now we don't." But he added, "There's always the option of saying no. The only options aren't the ones that are socially acceptable. More of us, and that means me too, need to start exercising the option of saying no." I'm Matt Rothschild. And that's how I see it.
Well, we have Ann Manning on right now. Ann is with the Wealth for the Common Good. Good morning, Ann. I'd like to welcome you to the Sarah Schultz Show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for coming on today. Now, what exactly is Wealth for the Common Good?
We are a network of business leaders and high-income households and other partner organizations, and we work together to promote shared prosperity and fair taxation. We know that over the last 30 years, particularly American workers, particularly the bottom 60% of American workers, really haven't gotten a fair shake. And we know that a lot of that has to do with our tax policies. So while we advocate on many issues, our particular focus is federal tax policy.
Well, some of these tax policies seem to have caused these inequalities. Is that
yes.
One of the reasons what we're seeing today? Where is the beginning to all of this?
You know, the way I look at it, if you look at the last 30 years and really ask why are the middle class struggling, why are the poor struggling more and more, all the research really shows that inequality has soared. And it's especially gotten out of control over the past 10 years. And if we look at what's happened, you see in the American workforce large, large productivity gains. And yet those gains that workers themselves have produced, the benefit, the profits from those gains are going into CEO salaries and they're going into shareholder returns. But the average worker has not had a raise in 30 years. Now, in the late 90s, things started to shift and we were seeing. You remember how there was, you know, bring a friend to the job fair, and if we hire them, we'll give you a bonus. Well, those days are over. But we were starting to see in the 90s some shift with people in the bottom 60% getting some increases, but those are gone now. So I think in 2004, the average household was making 16 in real dollars, in inflation-adjusted dollars, they were making $1,600 less than they were around 1980. So I think because we see small increases, we don't realize that the cost of fuel and housing and everything has just eaten up any particular raise we may have seen in the last 30 years. So that's one reason. Another reason, as I said, is a lot of the income has been shifted to the top, particularly the top 10% and even more so the top 1%. And a lot of that shift has gone to the financial markets, where people are making, you know, $4 billion a year. And while they're making that $4 billion a year, they're also paying taxes at a much lower rate. A lot of very, very wealthy people make their money through dividends and interest, and they are only taxed at 15%, whereas wages of your average working American are taxed at higher rates. And so we've got we've got this shift of wealth to the top and this shift of the tax burden downward. So I think those are two of the most important reasons. We also see that wealth has been unfairly distributed, and of course income has a piece of that, but the wealthy now own the top government and researchers tend to talk in quintiles, so the 20% of the bottom, the next 20%, all the way to the top 20%. The top 20% in this country now own 84% of all the wealth, and that's really almost unheard of. So those are some of the reasons we're seeing a big problem.
So is part of this the fact that the unions, which were kind of the checks and balances on the corporations, have gotten weaker as compared to the corporations then?
Yes, that's a huge piece. We don't have nearly as many people who are in unions, and we have seen this attack on unions. I've just started doing some reading about, you know, kind of when this started, and that incident when Ronald Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers was kind of the beginning of one of the most current attack on unions. And we have seen this steady, steady erosion, particularly of unions in the private sector. And now, of course, as you Wisconsinites know better than anybody, there's now the attack on public employee unions. And that when you can't advocate for yourself collectively. I mean, I know I spent 30 years in corporate America. If you go in one-on-one and advocate for increases, you don't get very far. You have to have a collective, and you have to have that wisdom of what's equitable here and be able to negotiate from a place of equality rather than a place of, you know, oh, my God, can I please have a small raise? That doesn't work very well. So, yes, you've hit that right on the nose. The lack of ability of people to organize and have strong unions is definitely a problem.
Now, we hear about the trickle down. Taxes, mm-hmm. My understanding of this is that when the taxes are high, people didn't want to keep the money because they're getting taxed on it, so they put it back into the corporation. When the taxes were low, they keep the money. Is that kind of what we're seeing at this point? So trickle-down doesn't work unless you have a higher? I mean, can you explain some of that?
Well, the idea that trickle-down will work, I think, is refuted not just in the tax policy, but in just what I just described about how income in corporations has grown, but it has not gone to the workers. So what I would see in my corporate experience was, if you're looking at, say, somebody working in the shipping department, then we want to compare wages to those even overseas. You know, so, well, we could get, if we put all of our shipping in Mexico, or we built this product in China, we can pay much lower wages. So we tend to want to compare people's wages globally if they're in the bottom 50 or 60%. But if you notice, CEO pay in this country is never compared to their compatriots overseas, because there's no other country in a democracy, in a Western-style democracy, that pays CEO pay at the rates that we do. So your average CEO doesn't want his compensation compared to anybody overseas, because it would be dramatically cut. But when he or she compares the workers in his or her corporation, then they want to compare them to low-wage workers in, you know, typically more third-world countries. And so the idea that trickle-down can work in that kind of system is ludicrous. It won't. So we have to really have, I think, strong unions, strong organizing, and a whole different framework on what a healthy society looks like. I'm probably getting ahead of myself here, but I think when I look at what my parents' generation and generations before that did. In the 50s, we had tax rates under Eisenhower, a Republican, under Eisenhower, top marginal rates on the wealthiest Americans were 91%. 91%. Now, that doesn't mean they paid 91% on all of their income, but on the highest dollar in portion of their incomes, they were paying the federal government 91%. And yet our country was thriving. We were building an interstate highway system. We were building marvelous public schools, beautiful, you know, parks that got built in the 30s during the Depression because we were wise enough to invest in public assets. So our parents and grandparents did sacrifice and make the investments necessary to build a strong economy. My international friends say, you know, the reason this country's so great is really because of our commitment to the common good. And I feel like we're really losing that.
So would it be better to actually take the multinational corporations instead of them saying, look at how expensive it is to pay for you versus having a sweatshop, basically, is what they're comparing it to.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be
mm-hmm.
better to have some legislation saying, okay, no matter where you go, you have to pay at least $6 an hour. You can't – I'm just throwing numbers out. I'm just giving examples.
Right,
you,
right.
You can't pollute in the country. You have to maintain certain standards. Would something like that help some of the stuff going on?
You know, I do think some of those things help. I'm particularly fond of don't pollute, you know, and that you have to pay – a livable wage in that country, you know, because I think running a sweatshop is just morally wrong no matter where you are. But you also don't want to distort an economy completely. So a $6 an hour wage may be far too out of whack in some countries, whereas, you know, perhaps a real middle-class income would be $4 an hour because goods and services cost different things in different countries. Just like in this country, it costs more to live in New York and Los Angeles than, say, it might in River Falls, Wisconsin. And so we have to be sensitive to the environment, but I do think we need some minimum standards about what it means. I also think we just need a mindset shift that I believe we have become a country that worships our economy, that we think, you know, that there really is nothing more important than, oh, my God, you can't upset the economy. Oh, my God, the economy. Well, the economy are people. We, you know, it's the people that matter, not corporate profits. We need corporate profits, but we have gotten out of whack on why we think corporations are valuable. They're valuable because they provide goods and services and because they allow for the people who live in the countries where they're located and around the globe, we're now all global citizens, to live decent lives. And so I don't have all the answers. I don't think anybody has all the answers about how we get from where we are today to a healthier understanding of how to create a healthy planet and a healthy economy. But the goal of any economy should be to allow its citizens to live good lives and to have a access to a shared common good. I mean, I'm lucky enough, I live in Minneapolis. Our city fathers, you know, 100 years ago, realized these beautiful city lakes should be common property. And so nobody owns the lake property in the city of Minneapolis. We all have access to these beautiful lakes, and it makes an enormous difference. So how do we restore our understanding of what the common good is? And the corporations are here to serve people. People are not here to serve corporations. I think we have the equation backwards right now.
Well, that brings into more of an equality. We're looking at getting a huge inequality coming up in here. Do you think that Americans would prefer more of a fair system, one that's more equal instead of, you know, we're seeing the separation. You're talking 84% of people have 20% of the wealth. Do you think people want to bring that together?
I do, and I'm loving that some of the new research supports it in pretty dramatic fashion. In fact, if your listeners want to get a clip of an understanding of this, the PBS NewsHour did a series, and I know the one particularly that looks at that question, I think, was August 16th. But two sources that I am particularly fond of, well, I have a lot of sources that I'm fond of, but two I'll mention today. One is a little book by Larry Jacobs and Ben Page called Class Wars, What Americans Really Think About Economic Equality. And they did their own study and then looked at a lot of other studies. And they say, yes, while we are, quote, philosophically conservative in that we believe that people should take care of themselves to the degree that they can and that free enterprise is a good thing, they also believe at an operational level they tend to be more progressive, so that they want people to never have to suffer extreme amounts of degradation by having lack of health care, lack of shelter, lack of food. You know, we're egalitarians. We want people to lead decent lives, and we want our government to make sure to step in and help when that's necessary. And a more recent study, these two people that they are interviewing on the PBS series, they did a fascinating study looking at, I think about 7,000 Americans across the political spectrum. They were in 47 states, average income, pretty average median income of 44,000, equal men and women. They looked at people who voted for Bush, people who voted for Kerry. They really have looked across the spectrum. And then what they did was they said, if you were going to be in a civilization or a society, they gave them three options for how they'd like the wealth distributed. And one option was every sector, the bottom 20% to the top, everybody got an equal amount. So everybody got a 20% of the wealth. And then they showed one where there was some inequality, but it wasn't terribly extreme. And then I think the top category got 36% of the wealth, and the bottom category got 11% of the wealth. And then they showed one that was fairly extreme. And over and over, doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat, you chose the there was inequality, but it wasn't extreme. Well, it turns out those three models, the first one, of course, doesn't exist. We don't have a culture that divides it equally. The second model, where there's some inequality, but it's not extreme, is actually Sweden. And the one where it's super extreme is the U.S. And then when they asked people, what do you think the American economy is? They didn't reveal that was the American economy yet. People tended to underestimate how extreme our inequality is. We know it's unequal, but most of us don't understand just how unequal it is. And people actually, I think, are quite horrified when they start looking at the real numbers. So if your listeners want to know where that is, they can Google Michael Norton, or I could send you a link to put on your website. Would that be easier?
That would be great. Yeah, I could Good. Post it on Facebook and get it up on everything.
Yeah, it's only a page or two, the summary of their work, and it's really worth looking at. But in our country, the top 20% own 84% of the wealth. And they then access, you know, they can just sit home and their wealth works for them. They don't have to go to work. Many of them do, but they don't have to. And their income then, millions of dollars of income, sometimes billions of dollars of income, is taxed at a lower rate than, you know, you and me and people, you know, whether it's a teacher or a welder or whoever going to work every day, we're subject to higher taxes than people who sometimes make $4 billion a year. There's something wrong with that. And it's not the American way.
And if you reverse those numbers, instead of saying 20% mm-hmm. of the population is 84% of it, you have 80% of the U.S. that owns 16% of the wealth.
Exactly. And the bottom 60% of Americans, so, you know, almost two-thirds of Americans own 4.3% of the wealth. That's stunning. the bottom 20% owns like 0.1%, the next 20% owns 0.2%, and the middle 20% owns 4%. So one of the things that's happened because of this financial deregulation and the housing bubble that occurred is what little bit of wealth the bottom half had is gone because it was in their house. And when their house values went down, they lost an enormous amount of wealth. This is especially true for people of color who were just beginning to get some equity and have a little bit of asset valuation, little tiny bit. And then those who have lost jobs have had to use their retirement and savings for college for their kids to live on. So wealth has declined in the bottom 60% over the last few years pretty dramatically, and it continues to grow at the top. They had a dip in 2008, but they recovered nicely in 2009 and 2010.
So basically, the average American, because you're looking at a bell curve, the average American
mm-hmm.
owns 4.3% of the wealth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that wouldn't be an average because the median might be the median. The average gets pulled up by the top. Yeah. But in the bottom, if you just had a chart of 0 to 100%, the bottom 60% owns about 4.3% of the wealth. Now that you got to separate wealth and income. They get a little bit more of the income, but they have to spend it every year. So wealth is really what you own minus what you owe. And so the bottom 60% of Americans really don't own much anymore. They're living pretty much paycheck to paycheck.
We're talking to Ann Manning from Wealth for the Common Good. If you have any questions, please call in at 310-742-1896. Now, we are in an economic crisis. We have the decline of the working and middle class. We have lack of jobs. We have an economy that just doesn't seem to be rebounding. What's going on here? What's the cause of these things?
I really think that we have to shift the framework that we have a deficit problem to we have a jobs problem. The more we focus on cutting the deficit and cutting government spending, I think the deeper in the hole we're going to get. This recovery has made me even more of a Keynesian than I was before. I really get that. If you think about if in 2009, right after, the crisis of fall of 08, if we had done a massive jobs program and looked at what does America need right now, I know because I live in a little neighborhood that whenever we have an electrical storm, I can be out of electricity for hours. Because we don't have the money to upgrade the system for some reason. I don't know why. But we don't have, so we just, here I live in a perfectly wonderful city in a very nice neighborhood in Minneapolis, and I feel like I'm starting to live in a third world country. Our electrical grids are out of, are truly need to be upgraded. Apparently our sewer systems are in dire shape. We know from the bridge collapse and then assessing bridges around the country that civil engineers give us a D or a D minus on our bridges. If you travel overseas and look at their transportation systems, it's very clear our transportations are becoming more and more antiquated. We're going to be kind of third world in that arena before long. So if we had said we're going to invest in America the way our parents did in the 1950s, and government then would have, yes, government would have had to have paid the bill, but how would they have done it? They would have hired private companies, private industry, to build new schools, to build an electric grid, to clean up, and repair our water systems, to build 21st century infrastructure. Those workers then would have money in their pocket to spend. The companies doing the work directly need supplies. That means more manufacturing jobs get added to supply all the materials to do this investment. All those people now have paychecks. They're going out in the community and buying things. They're putting their kids through college. They're taking a vacation. They're buying a new car, a new refrigerator. You know, life gets better for everybody. It flows throughout the community. And they're paying taxes. So the government is starting to recoup the investment pretty much immediately. And people are not getting the unemployment checks or spending their savings. They're actually contributing back into the country. And I don't see any other way for us to get out of that except to invest. And one way we can afford to invest is to change our tax policies. You know, if we end the Bush tax cuts and end all the corporate loopholes that now allow companies like GE to pay no taxes, we can do an amazing amount with that revenue by investing in things that are important. I am not a believer that the answer to this is to tell everybody to go shopping at the mall. I don't think that kind of spending is very helpful. It's not that we don't want to do some of that, but the bulk of the money needs to get spent in rebuilding this country and making it a 21st century country. And the planet can't afford for us to keep buying throwaway goods. We need to invest in things that are long-lasting and sustainable. And then, of course, the other thing we can do is try to get out of these two unfunded wars we've been in for a decade. That would save us a lot of money.
That's a, some of these are subjects all on their own to be talked about later.
They are.
There's a lot that goes on with all this. I'm going to get back to the jobs. You said it was a job problem.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the cause of lack of jobs that are, you know, the lack of jobs in America are? Is this a product of outsourcing, just factories leaving, something totally different, a combination?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is a combination of several things. So reason that corporations aren't hiring, even though
and,
they have tons and tons. Oh, sure.
Wait 1 second. I'm sorry. You were really getting distorted, so I'm not sure what you were doing. So maybe it's just me, but
No, you know, every now and then I'm on an iPhone. Maybe it's sometimes it gets a little crazy.
Okay.
Is it better?
That's perfect. Yeah, just every it did it a little bit, but it just kept going. I'm like, I want people to hear what you have to say. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. No, no, and do interrupt because every now and then it does an echo chamber kind of thing, and I never know why. Maybe Apple can fix that. So the things that I think one of the reasons that corporations stopped hiring and laid off so many people is that when we had the crash and we lost something like 2 million jobs, well, people stopped spending. And then I know people in my neighborhood who have work, but they're not working up to capacity. So I have a lot of friends who, you know, are writers and graphic artists and who have had their own business for 20, 30 years, and the work just dried up, and so they're doing work, but they're making a lot less money. So they're not buying a new car. They're not taking a vacation to their cabin, you know, some little resort in northern Wisconsin. And so then that means the people who run the resorts, they don't have the money to spend. So it's that trickle effect of people lose jobs, they quit spending, and then people got scared, and rightly so, started paying down debt whenever they had extra money. And so the demand for goods and services in this country dropped off dramatically. And because, as I said, Americans in the bottom 60% haven't had a raise in 30 years, people don't have the money to shop the way they used to. And it's very important to understand, particularly in the 2000s, the demand came through spending home equity, because our homes were going up fast, and everybody was saying, oh, refinance, take out $30,000, and you can buy a sailboat. Well, people did that. And now their houses are underwater, and they still owe $30,000 on a sailboat that's now only worth $15,000. And so lots of demand has shrunk because workers, average Americans, don't have the money anymore to go and spend that they did. So they were using two things. They were using their mortgage equity, and they were using credit cards. And so as people started to pull in after the economy crashed and stopped spending, demand dries up. And so corporations are not going to start hiring until demand increases. So we're in a catch-22. They won't hire, and demand won't go up until workers have money in their paychecks. So we're at a stalemate, And I don't see how it changes unless the federal government actually invests, as I described earlier. The other piece is a mismatch of skills, and I've just started doing some homework on this. There was an article this week, and as I said, I live across the river in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities area. The governor was up in northern Minnesota, so I assume there may be similarities to northern Wisconsin or any part of Wisconsin, where they actually have some job demand. There are companies that are trying to hire skilled workers like welders, but they don't. The local people don't have those skills. And one woman who said, you know, her company's hiring, she said, I can't hire a worker if they don't know how to use a tape measure. And so I think we have to get back to how do we, another place for us to invest is in education. We need to do retraining, but oh, I'm just such a believer. We got to start with early childhood. Every child needs high quality early childhood. We know if we get them off to a good start, they'll stay in school, they'll do well. Their chances of a successful life and being a productive citizen are just increased dramatically. So I do think we have a lack of demand because too many people don't have enough money to go buy things, and we have some mismatch of skills. A lot of the jobs out there are not able to be accessed by the people who actually need work. And then again, that lack of, I believe the solution is a government stimulus plan.
Do you think part of it is that we have a host of lower paying jobs? If you're paying $8, $9 an hour, $7.50, whatever minimum wage is set at, do you think that something like that, people are just scraping to get by? You think higher paying jobs that offer a little bit more would help bring the economy back a little?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, we need to find a way to help corporations begin to pay Americans their fair share. And as I said, because of the productivity gains, workers in America deserve a lot more in their paychecks than they're getting. And somehow we need to shift that mindset across the country about what a livable wage job is. And then I think, you know, I think the whole Rick Perry candidacy brings that your question into stark relief. You know, he's proudly saying that, you know, Texas has come up with something like 2/3 of the new jobs in the country since the recession. But some of that's because of their oil resources. The overwhelming number of jobs that Texas has produced are very low-wage jobs. And so people have to work 2 or 3 of them to put together any kind of a livable wage. And I don't think that's the kind of country we want to live in. I don't think that's something to be proud of. We need well-paying jobs. And it's more complicated, again, I think, than I don't know that anyone has the answer to how to move forward in a very prescriptive way and how to raise average worker pay. But I think continuing to look at minimum wage legislation, getting it, you know, we just let it stagnate for decades. And if we had kept up, you know, with that minimum wage through the 80s and 90s and kept increasing it as CEO and management pay and professional pay were going up, if we kept that going up, I think we'd be in a whole different place. But we just let that stagnate. And so workers really did not see the benefits of the growth in our economy over the last 30 years.
Is there anything we could do to really help ourselves in this situation?
You mean as an individual or as a collective?
Both.
When you say ourselves, yeah. Well, I think as individuals, we can certainly, you know, look at the job market and say, are there jobs, you know, going unfulfilled? And is that something do I have the ability and the interest to get trained to do that job? For example, these welding jobs, as I described. And then second, I think we have to be more willing to act together. I think one of the downsides of our tremendous psyche of individualism in this country is when we're in a contraction period like we've been in the last couple of years. And again, I don't believe we needed to go here. I think that was the fault of deregulation on Wall Street that really caused the majority of the pain of this. We need to come out of our homes and talk to each other. But I think when we've lost our job or, you know, if we're consultants and our income has dramatically declined, Americans tend to blame themselves. It must be my fault that I'm not doing well. And we go into kind of a shame reaction. And what we need to do is go out and talk to each other, find ways to connect, and really start to talk, just like what happened in Wisconsin. You know, I think you guys are the most beautiful example of people coming together to say, we've had enough, no further. We are gonna build a society that works for everybody. So, for example, wealth for the common good, we talk a lot about shared prosperity. We have not had shared prosperity. So I think there are things we can do as individuals, but the most important work right now really is the collective work, that we have to say very clearly what kind of world we want to live in and demand that our political and business leaders step up to the plate and help create that. There is a group, by the way, and I'll see if I can find it while we're talking, of
Well, while you're doing that, I'm going to give out your website, your group's website.
Oh, great.
It's www.wealthforcommongood.org, all one word, all spelled out.
Mm-hmm.
And I will put that on my Facebook page so people can click on and read about more about what you guys are doing.
That would be wonderful, yes. There's a website about inequality that is very good, and I will send that to you. And then there are also I'm sorry, I'm not finding it right now, but there are groups that you can get kind of a little workbook and figure out how to bring, say, a neighborhood together or a church group and begin to talk about how do we come together and support each other. It may be, why do we all have a lawnmower? Why can't we share a lawnmower in the neighborhood and cut expenses that way? Or my neighborhood, we share a big snowblower. I live on an alley that's just not, that the city doesn't take care of. It's a private alley because of the way it was built in the 20s. We're responsible for it. And so we now own a very large snowblower so that we can take care of our alley instead of everybody trying to figure out how we're going to do this. How do we come together? So I think those are some of the things we want to be looking at.
And with that, I'd like to thank you for being on the show today, Anne.
Well, it was wonderful. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It was. I learned a lot, and would love to have you come back on and talk about some of the things you mentioned about maybe the wars. Definitely healthcare. Healthcare is a big part of this. So,
right.
We'll definitely
I'd be
happy
to.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you. Bye, Sarah.
Bye. That was Anne Manning from Wealth for the Common Good. Again, their website is www.wealthforcommongood.org. And when she sends those links that she's talking about, I will definitely get them on my Facebook page, The Sarah Schultz Show, so you can click on it. It will be on Twitter as well, at Sarah Schultz Show. Now, The Sarah Schultz Show, my show, is looking for sponsors and donations. If you're interested in sponsoring a show or giving a donation to keep the show going, please contact me at sarahschultzshow@gmail.com. And if you haven't listened, Unscripted with Mike and Jeff, they are great. There are a couple guys from New York. They're daily. They're from, I think it's 9 to 10 their time, 8 to 9 Central Standard Time. They talk about just the news of the day. They had a great show last week on autism. They are in the chat room right now, so if they just want to post their link, that would be great, and I'll get that out to people, because if you're not listening to them, they're great. Now I'm going to get into the recorded interview of Tamarine Cornelius. She is with the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families and the Wisconsin Budget Project. This was done yesterday, so here we go.
I'd like to welcome Tamarine Cornelius to the Sarah Schultz Show. Tamarine is with the Wisconsin Budget Project and the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Thank you for coming on the show today, Tamarine.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. First, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the Wisconsin Budget Project and the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Can you give my listeners an idea of who you guys are and what you guys do?
Well, the Wisconsin Budget Project is an initiative of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. And Wisconsin Council on Children and Families is a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy research organization. We actually are celebrating our 130th year now, founded in 1881, and has the goal of ensuring that every child grows up in a just and nurturing society. So we focus on policy areas like health care, early childhood education, juvenile justice, and budget and tax policy, and that's where the Wisconsin Budget Project comes in. It's an initiative of WCCF that focuses on state budget and, to a lesser extent, other budget issues.
Well, how does the Wisconsin budget actually impact the average Wisconsin family?
There are just a myriad of ways that people are going to be affected, in particular by this budget that just got passed, because it includes such significant changes and such enormous cuts to state programs. We are all going to feel those changes. The number one place that the program that the state spends more money on than any other program is public K-12 education. And most of us are affected in some way by K-12 education, whether you have children in the public school system or not. And there are there's an enormous disinvestment in public education in this budget that we are all going to be feeling. There's also some really, there's some significant tax changes. There's significant cuts to health care assistance for working families. There's not just in public K-12 education, but higher education and training opportunities for workers. Those are going to be diminished. Transit, changes to unemployment benefits. I mean, the question is less how are people impacted by the state budget, but it's almost more of a challenge to find an area where people aren't going to be feeling the effects of the state budget.
Well, can you give some examples of some of those? I mean, that was a long list to go through. Can you just, a little tax change, maybe something, we know some of the health care, but maybe something that hasn't come out a lot in the media.
Sure. Well, one of the things that hasn't gotten a whole lot of press or a whole lot of coverage is the tax changes that have been enacted since the first of the year. So some of them were in the budget, and then some of them were in a special legislative session that the governor called as soon as he came into office, a session that focused on job creation. So during that special session back in January, the legislature enacted 4 tax cuts. And then in the budget, they an additional 3 tax cuts were put into place. So the total tax cuts from these tax cuts that have happened since the first of the year, over 2 years, because that's how Wisconsin budgets on a 2-year basis, so most of these figures are 2-year figures, that's $210 million over the next 2 years in tax cuts that have been put into place since the beginning of the year. And some of these tax cuts are phased in so that they have greater effect in later years. So of those tax cuts, the total over 10 years is just over $2 billion. And all of those tax cuts benefit either businesses or predominantly wealthy individuals. There were also 2 tax increases in the budget, which will result in lower income families or individuals paying more in taxes. So the effect of $200 million in tax cuts at a time when we are putting into place just massive cuts in programs that help make our communities safe, help educate our children, help make our cities livable, we are reducing the resources that we have to raise our standard of living when we put into place these tax cuts primarily aimed at businesses and wealthy.
What are some of the budget impacts for the people of color? Now we've talked, I said average, and average is middle class family. Your people of color or your working class families, a lot of them will coexist. What are the impacts for them?
Well, there's going to be some pretty significant impacts, some of which actually are still unknown because some of the changes that have happened since the beginning of the year give the state additional powers to make changes to programs important to these families without having a lot of public input. So they're going to be able, they now have a broader ability to make changes to Badger Care without public input, as well as child care assistance, both of which are important for families who are working, who are trying to lift themselves out of poverty, and getting some assistance in those efforts. So for a typical family, it's, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the effects will be, in part, like I said, because they have additional leeway in making some of these changes. But we ran some figures to talk about what a typical family might see in these changes. So one of the tax increases is a cut in the earned income tax credit, which goes to working class families with children. You have to be working and you have to have children. And there's probably also going to be some increase in premium costs for Badger Care, which is health insurance for people who are working. There could be additional co-payments for people receiving child care assistance. So when you add all these things up, working class families could see costs of you know, somewhere between a couple hundred dollars to a couple thousand dollars, depending on their circumstance.
Would that be per month, or is that...
No, annually.
Annually, yeah. Okay.
We also, yesterday was the first day that public employees or state employees will see the effects. Yesterday was the first paycheck for state employees with the additional contributions taken out for a greater share of their health insurance costs and a greater share of their retirement costs. So that is going to have an impact on working class families, which are more likely to be families of color. You know, a lot of people think that there aren't necessarily lower paid public workers, but that's not the case. We took a look at, for example, how much a janitor working at the at a university how big the hit might be to their wallet, so to speak, between their cut in compensation from the cut to public workers, as well as other changes that are reducing the support for lower income families. And we found that these families might have a cut of up to 15% of their income. For example, this janitor, let's say he makes $24,000 a year and has two children, for which he gets child care assistance. His family budget could take a hit of about $3,600 a year. So that's about 4.5 months of groceries for him, and that's spread out among several reductions in state programs, as well as the cut to his actual paycheck.
So that's $3,000 coming out of the community.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And you know, what we've essentially done is rolled back supports for lower income working families who tend to spend the money right away and go into the economy. And we've also put in tax cuts for wealthy individuals and businesses who don't always inject that money as quickly into the economy. So we are working against any stimulative effect that that money might have for our economy.
Well, and the tax cuts, are they more geared towards your multinational, more bigger corporations, your small, your mom and pop stores, your smaller businesses that would put money back, that are paying local people to work there? They're the ones that are they the ones getting hit the hardest then with some of this as well?
Some of the tax cuts are aimed at multi-state or larger companies. There's one of the tax changes. We had a tax change a couple years ago that prevented multi-state companies from shielding income in other states that didn't have a corporate income tax. There was a change in the budget that partially rolled that back, so that's going to cost us about $46 million over 2 years. There was also a tax cut for manufacturers, which when fully phased in will reduce manufacturers' corporate income tax by about 95%. So they'll be paying virtually nothing when it's fully phased in.
Is that a two-year process to phase it in?
It's actually a 5 or 6 year process.
Okay.
Yeah.
So within 6 years, they're going to be paying almost no income tax.
That's right.
Okay.
Virtually none. There's also a change to capital gains taxes, where taxes, money that you earn from things like stock profits, are taxed differently than money that you earn by working. And this rolls back some of those taxes, and that overwhelmingly benefits people with higher incomes. There's one of the first tax breaks that was put in at the beginning of this year was a tax credit for health savings accounts, which is an account that you can use if you to have non-taxed health spending if you have a certain type of health insurance. People who have HSAs have incomes about twice as high as those who don't. So again, that predominantly benefits wealthy individuals.
Do you know what the capital gains tax is? Do you have any information on that?
You mean what the change is?
Yeah.
Well, the one that goes right into place is that investors can defer capital gain taxes if the profits are reinvested in Wisconsin businesses. Oh, and then that was one change, and then the second one was that investors pay no state taxes on profits resulting from the sale of Wisconsin assets if purchased in 2011 or later and held on for at least 5 years. That one won't have a fiscal effect until 5 years from now. But over 10 years, those two changes together will represent about $400 million lost to the state in terms of revenue. Oh, and here I see that says those people making $200,000 or more make up less than 2% of all tax filers in Wisconsin, but they make up 46% of all the profits, capital gains profits, excluded from taxes. So you can see that predominantly benefits the wealthy.
So what we're seeing here is you're seeing more of a separation going on. You're seeing the working class and middle class families that are being almost pushed down, whereas the people who are making the money seem to be able to bring in more. So you're seeing a greater separation between the two.
This budget definitely is balanced on the backs of working class families, and also puts into place tax cuts for, again, that primarily, not exclusively, but primarily benefit wealthy people and companies.
The Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, you guys had a great blog in July called 31 Ways in 31 Days. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and some of the stuff you're doing now?
Well, I also put in a pitch for the Wisconsin Budget Project, because we also have a blog that we post to a couple times a week about all sorts of budget-related issues, anything from, I don't know, sales tax on online purchases to plans by presidential tax plans of presidential candidates to what's going on in the state budget. So you should take a look at the Wisconsin Budget Project blog. And then Wisconsin Council on Children and Families also has a blog where we focus on policy issues relating to, again, juvenile justice, health care, early education, and budget and tax.
Well, what's the blog? First, let's go back to the blog for the Wisconsin budget. What is that blog website?
It's wisconsinbudgetproject.blogspot.com. That's the Wisconsin Budget Project blog. And then the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families blog is WISKids, WISKids.blogspot.com.
And I'll post both of those on the Sarah Schultz Facebook page.
Great. So
that way people can access them.
And after the budget was passed, we wanted to make sure that people understood all the ways that this budget would affect children and families, because there's just dozens of ways that this is going to do that. We also wanted to make sure that we had sort of a listing of how this would affect children and families so that as we go forward, we can take a look at if this is a way we want to continue to do things, if this is a way we want to continue to support our children and families, because we're going to have to make these decisions all over again in a couple of years with the next budget. So for every day in July, which is also the start of the new fiscal year when a lot of these budget changes go into place, we highlighted a different way that children and families were going to be impacted by changes made in the state budget. So we had 31 ways, and it really was not hard at all to come up with 31 ways. We started with a much larger list and had to whittle them down to 31 ways. And each day we highlighted one way that children will be affected, and then also if we thought that there was a better way, we talked about a different approach that we could have taken or in the future we might be able to take. So we talked about issues like cuts to public education, cuts to Badger Care, changes to child care assistance, the increase in UW tuition, the freeze in financial aid. One juvenile detention facility was closed. There's changes to mass transit, some of the tax changes that we talked about. There's even changes to child labor laws in the budget. So every day we took a day to focus on a different issue, good or bad. There were a couple good ones in there too.
Well, do you see any differences with the effect of urban versus rural with the children and the effects from them?
Well, to the extent that sometimes rural families don't have the same resources or availability to resources that that urban families do, and as we make changes to the availability of state programs, and rural families might have to go farther. Also, Badger Care is a very important resource for rural families for health to get their health care. And there's going to be a lot of changes to Badger Care coming up, or there could be a lot of changes to Badger Care coming up. So to that extent, the rural families, I think, are also going to be hard hit. But I think the real difference is the working class versus other, upper income. I think that is the right lens to look at a lot of these changes.
So if we're looking at working class, we're also looking at some of the Native American on the reservations. We're looking at your African American, your Hmong. I mean, it's not just there's
right.
A lot incorporated with that, and a lot of these people are already struggling for stuff.
Well, and there are some changes in the budget for immigrant families. For example, a couple years ago there was a change where undocumented students could get in-state tuition at UW system and technical college systems if they met certain criteria. They had to be here. They basically had to have gone to high school here, and they had to be on the road or starting the process to obtain citizenship. Then they could have in-state tuition at the technical college or the university system. That change was eliminated in this budget that was rolled back. So So now undocumented students will pay, you know, three times the tuition of somebody else that they graduated from high school with. There's also a change in the budget. The federal government pays for most of the food stamps benefits, except for certain legal immigrants. The federal government does not pay for those, but the state has paid for those. The state is now eliminating that benefit, so certain legal immigrants will no longer have access to the food stamps.
So if you're in here, because it takes a while to get your citizenship, so if you're in here, you're here legally, you're working at maybe minimum wage, or maybe you got laid off, or whatever the case is, you go to apply for food stamps, doing everything legally, you're not going to get them?
There's some conditions that that I think has to do with how long you've been here, but some of those families would no longer be eligible for food stamps. That's right.
Wow, you guys are doing a thankless and wonderful service being out there and putting all this out for people to see, and you make it so it's easy for people to understand. These are very complex stuff. This was a huge bill, and you guys did a great job at doing that. Is there any way people can help you guys out?
Well, we do have a Facebook page that people might find interesting to look at. We post all our information there about what we're doing, as well as newspaper articles and things. So you could take a look at that. And I guess just kind of come and take a look at what we are, what we're doing on our webpage. We have two webpages, which is WCCF.org. That's the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families one. And then there's also the Wisconsin Budget Project one, which is WisconsinBudgetProject.org, as well as our Facebook pages. And we also have Twitter accounts, which are pretty easy to find too. I found a little more information about the food share, which is the official name for food stamps, which is if you have lived in the United States less than five consecutive years, those people will now no longer be eligible for food stamps because the state used to fund that portion, and in this budget, that was eliminated. So that's about 0.2% of people receiving food share in Wisconsin.
What's the savings on that? If you had to put it into a monetary, what do they?
You know, I have that, but I have to go. It's not very much, I have to say. I think it's between $1 and $2 million, and I have that, but it's in a big notebook.
Tamarine is looking for that right now, so I'm going to go over some of those websites again. The Wisconsin Budget Project is the WisconsinBudgetProject.org, and their blog is WisconsinBudgetProject.blogspot.com. If you want to go to the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, it's WCCF.org. And their blog is WisKids.blogspot.com. They also have a couple Facebook pages. You can sign up. Actually, I have actually signed up with the Wisconsin Budget Project. It comes into my email every time they release something. It's great. It keeps you right on top of stuff. They make it very easy to understand. I try to pass it on. They put it on the Facebook page too. Really, I really recommend you get in on some of this because it's something easy you can give to your friends and say, hey, this is what's really going on in Wisconsin, and this is how you are going to be affected, and this was done by nonpartisan. So,
I found the fiscal effect of the changes whereby those immigrants will no longer be eligible for food stamps, and it'll over 2 years, it will save about $800,000. And this will affect about 1,500 people per month who get food share benefits.
Per month? So 1,500 people per month with a two-year savings of $800,000.
Mm-hmm.
So this actually blows my mind. We're looking at people who are legally here, working, struggling, who have been here for maybe 4.5 years, who may not qualify to get food because they're not citizens, even though they've legally gone. And it's 1,500 people. That's not... I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a lot of people to starve every year, every month. And you're saving $800,000 for 2 years, so it's $400,000 each year. that boggles the mind that people, that they have a budget that allows people to not eat in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, I wonder how much this actually has to do with savings. My guess would be that this one was not motivated by savings, since it's not very much money. For example, the change to the immigrant, where immigrants, where undocumented students who have been here for several years and graduate from high school here are no longer eligible for in-state tuition, that the fiscal effect of that was so small that the Fiscal Bureau, when they figure out the fiscal effect, didn't even consider it to have a fiscal effect because it affects such a small number of students. So again, that one was not, I think, motivated primarily by savings. But I also want to put in a plug for, I found the answer to that, the question, you know, how much is this saving, how much is this going to, how many people will this affect, in a document that we put together called a comparative analysis of the biennial budget bill, which is on our website, and it has all sorts of changes that affect children and families in areas like health or human services, as well as environment, corrections, higher education, aid to local governments, really a lot of different ways that could affect children and families, and then has kind of a breakdown on how that particular provision fared through the budget process, what the bottom line was, and what the changes are, and the fiscal effect of those changes. It is 42 pages, but it's actually fairly readable, I think, compared to a lot of the more comprehensive summaries that you see that can run to several hundred pages.
And that's on the WisconsinBudgetProject.org website?
That's right.
Okay. And you can save it, download it, print
mm-hmm.
it out?
Mm-hmm. It's a PDF.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's another good one to look at. So if you're trying to figure out what the budget is, where it saves, and how it affects you, and you want an overall comprehensive, easy to understand, another thing to get to. Well, I'd like to thank Tamarine Cornelius for being on today. She is with the Wisconsin Budget Project and Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Again, their website is www.wisconsinbudgetproject.org and www.wccf.org. Thank you very much for being on, and we'll hope to have you on again.
Thank you, Sarah.
And that was Tamarine Cornelius with the Wisconsin Budget Project and the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Now, we have about 15 minutes left, so I'm going to get right to Harry Westbrunn from the Jobs Party. If you have any questions for Harry, please call 310-742-1896 or toll free at 877-497-1797. Hi, Harry. Thank you for being on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I know I wanted to start out actually talking about student organization, but because jobs have been such an important thing, let's just jump to the job party, and we'll see if we can get back to the student organization. And if not, we'll get you on again to talk about that. That's super important. But can you talk a bit more about this job party that and how it got started and what the movement's about?
And certainly, and I'd also preface by saying that I see student organizing as intrinsically related to what we're trying to do with the job party. Because I think that the entirety of the college experience has changed now that from day one, everyone's worried about how they're going to get a job and not just graduate off a cliff with tens of thousands of dollars worth of debt and no way to pay it off, especially right out of college after you have to move in back home with mom and dad. The way the job party started was I had moved to New York and I met another one of our co-founders named Bob Furtick, who had a vision for, after the 2010 elections, how we basically needed a counter to the Tea Party from the progressive side, a single-issue organization to really change the conversation and then focus purely on jobs, which, especially at that time and continuing to now, people just aren't talking about in the terms that it really needs to be. And what happened is once we had launched, essentially what we were even talking about launching, within days, the Wisconsin uprising began, and we started pretty much with a couple days' notice. We overnight shipped 50 cheese heads from Wisconsin, and we started holding large-scale cheese head rallies outside of Fox News. And what we found, as we held a series of these, is they just kept on getting bigger and bigger. People in New York wanted to show this solidarity with Wisconsin and wanted to come out and especially scream at an organization like Fox News, which we know from a national level is responsible for what's happening locally in Wisconsin. And it was at these rallies, as they kept on getting bigger and as they started getting media attention, particularly from Ed Schultz, it was what instigated Move On and what was then called Defend the Dream and has since become Rebuild the Dream to hold Wisconsin rallies in all 50 state capitals around the country. So it really helped lead. They were very proud of the fact that it helped lead to that nationalization of the Wisconsin movement. And I'd say a lot of what we're trying to do and what we've been doing is taking the fight back in Wisconsin and trying to figure out what we can do not only to help it in Wisconsin from places like New York, but also how we could help the country to figure out how we could take what's working in Wisconsin and what's true about that movement and actually build it in a way that can impact the whole country.
Well, what's your tie to Wisconsin?
The job party or me personally, or both?
You personally, because normally people from New York or in the East Coast are not looking to Wisconsin. Well, they are now because we're in the news a lot, but when it started, people aren't going, oh, there's rallies in Wisconsin. That kicked in later. What brought your attention to it?
Well, I grew up in Milwaukee. I was graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2009. I was a student organizer throughout, and it was very surreal that once I had left, I felt like almost like immediately after, that's when all of a sudden this massive mobilization happened on what was my home turf. And the tie-in with the job party came is just it was as natural as we could expect. We see that movement we named the job party, that we see that people mobilizing in Wisconsin for and about jobs, I think collective bargaining, all these issues. I think that the umbrella issue is that people want jobs and good jobs and to feel secure in their lives. And they think that government, in many ways, should not only not be making those jobs worse or making it harder to have jobs, but should be creating jobs. And we actually have a major plank in our platform is we call for a 21st century WPA, the exact opposite of what's happening in Wisconsin, especially and then nationally now in terms of the government cutting all these services and cutting all these things that would create jobs or make jobs better or make people's lives better, and doing the complete opposite, having massive government spending like we had after the Great Depression to create jobs now.
And it's interesting you say that because Ann Manning, who was on first with the, I don't have her thing, there we go, the Wealth for the Common Good, I knew I'd get it eventually, she said the same thing. She said we need to put money into the infrastructure. We need to get private companies, public companies, to go in and spend money, and that's how we get our jobs going, and we need to make sure they're good-paying jobs. She said this isn't a money issue. This is a jobs issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the biggest cause of the deficit is that all these people are unemployed or underemployed, and they're no longer paying the kind of taxes that they would have otherwise. It causes huge deficits to have a jobs crisis like we have, and you can't really address the deficit without addressing the jobs crisis. But sadly, no one in Washington is even having that conversation. It's actively being papered over as nationally, even people that are typically on our sides have been embracing austerity. It's not even like they're going into saying they're being forced by the Republicans to do these massive cuts. Nationally, people are embracing this concept that there needs to be shared sacrifice on the backs of working families. And it's ridiculous and it's insidious and it's the opposite conversation of what we need to be having.
So this party is a grassroots type of party that started within the student population moving out.
I'd say that it's, and then to be clear, it's a movement. We're not a political party per se. We feel like we can back candidates the way that Tea Party does is really the best way to describe it. But we're very movement based. I think the beginning of it and the way we look at it is, I mean, our headquarters, our six co-founders are all based in New York. Here's where we have the most direct impact on the ground here. But we just name the movement. I mean, we feel like people are part of the job party and they don't even know it because they're activating for all of these different issues, but they all tie into jobs. So we think that nationally people need to be on the same page about what we're really fighting for and have that single issue focus, saying, you know, things like Social Security and Medicare, all the other issues that seem ancillary end up going to the same place. And even we talk about the movement to rebuild the American Dream, which the John Perry is a proud sponsor, proud partner of. The American Dream itself is intrinsically related to having a good job where you feel like your life can be stable, where if you have a job that you work your whole life, you should be able to retire with dignity, and you shouldn't have to worry about insurance companies literally putting your life at risk.
Now, how was the Job Party involved in the Bloombergville?
Bloombergville began as an outgrowth of what was called the On May 12th rallies. They had a big mobilization for the budget bill in New York, where Mayor Bloomberg was threatening massive teacher layoffs and all sorts of austerity measures, not to the same extent as what Walker would like to do, but the same within the same theory that, you know, austerity is something that we need. So there was a big mobilization, and as part of it, people talked about, and they extended just a little bit of research at the time to Bloombergville. And since that, it became a truly organic grassroots thing because people just decided to do it, even though they didn't have the support of big organizations or big unions. It's just people kind of showed up and stayed. And when it first happened, I immediately obviously knew that this was an inspiration from Walkerville. As I came by with my flip camera, and I started helping out wherever I could, however I could. And it really was a touching experience seeing from both sides. Like when I came there and I said, I'm from Wisconsin, and people in Wisconsin need to know about this. They were floored that anyone in Wisconsin would be curious about it or would much less be flattered or inspired. And when I went to people in Wisconsin and told them about this, I had immediately the same reaction from them too. They were shocked that people in New York were able to follow what they did at Walkerville and were being likewise inspired. So I think what was most amazing about that experience is seeing how from places like New York, Wisconsin, across the country, as little contact as we have, not only can these ideas spread, but that they become mutually reinforcing, where just having the actions and giving credit to the people that inspired you makes it that much easier to have these kind of actions or to have for people to keep up the fight. And, you know, Bloombergville was not easy. It was very different than Walkerville in terms of the fact that you're not allowed to have tents in New York because of homeless people. They would just don't want them setting up tents on the sidewalk. The lights never go off in New York. The traffic never stops. And there are rodents on the streets. So it's a very – Bloombergville, I presume, is a very different thing than basically camping out front of the Capitol, which was extremely difficult and in its own right, especially in winter. But I think that it speaks a lot to not only the participants but just, like, what it takes to do these kind of things. Like, if you're able to inspire someone like that to take it up a notch like that, I think it's so crucial to the movement. And – just from a media standpoint, I look at a lot of what I do as media activism, just making and spreading videos of people in cheeseheads thanking people in Wisconsin from New York. And then seeing Jesse Russell at Dane 101 was able to put together a series of videos of people in Wisconsin that took part in Walkerville wearing a Statue of Liberty hat, thanking the people in Bloombergville in New York. It was a humbling experience, and it was one that I thought really shows the way in terms of 21st century activism.
Well, we just have about a minute left here, minute and a half left. Can you, I've got so many other questions, we'll definitely have you back on, but can you get more information for people in Wisconsin who want to link up with the Job Party and start working with you? Where can they go to get that? How do they do that?
Well, the first place to go is our website, which is jobparty.us. We're very active on Twitter and Facebook, at Job Party, Facebook, just Job Party. And we strive to work as much as we can with Wisconsin organizers, and particularly with the Paul Ryan sit-in and the mobilization against Paul Ryan. I see a whole lot of potential for collaboration from Wisconsin to New York once again in the mode of Bloombergville to Walkerville, because Paul Ryan is such a national figure, and I think that these outbursts happening across the country at all these town halls all related to the Paul Ryan plan. And I think once again, and as always, Wisconsin's going to inspire the nation, and the job party's here to help.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank you for coming on, Harry. We have 10 seconds left, so we'll catch you next. We'll get you on next time. So I'd like to thank everyone for listening to The Sarah Schultz Show. Have a great day. Listen to me at the Democracy Convention, and I will see you next week.
Order, 14 senators, capital disorder, 14 senators, new Wisconsin heroes. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. Governor 0.